The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Brian, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is July 13, 2021. This panel of the court today has five cases on its calendar, three of which will be submitted with oral argument and two of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A21-223, James Lamar Davis versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, as you know, we allow each of you 15 minutes for your principal argument, and then appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You should be able to see the time clock on your screen if you have a gallery view setting or a similar setting. So you should be able to see how much time you have remaining. If there are no further questions, counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, Seth Leventhal on behalf of James Lamar Davis, also known as Javon Davis, the appellant. The Minnesota Imprisonment and Exoneration Remedies Act, which I will call the MIRA, is the legislature's recognition that wrongfully convicted and imprisoned people who are exonerated and who can prove their innocence should receive compensation for the time they spent as innocent people in Minnesota jails and prisons. Some people think this is a bad law. It's the taxpayers, after all, who bear the brunt of that compensation. It's controversial. Some people say, Mr. Davis had a bad lawyer. That's not the state's fault. The state shouldn't have to compensate him. They're free to question the wisdom or the value of the statute, but it is a statute. It is legislation. The legislature has spoken, and this court and the trial court are not in a position to question the wisdom of the statute or whether or not they think it's a good statute, which I would respectfully submit is what the trial court in essence has done here and the state's position here. At its essence, the state's position in this case is questioning the wisdom of the statute. The words in the statute...
Counsel, I don't necessarily think that the state's questioning the wisdom of the statute. I think the state is questioning whether the circumstances here are square with Freeman, which I think is governing under these circumstances. Do you want to talk about why your circumstances are different than the circumstances in Freeman?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, Freeman was specifically by the Court of Appeals limited to its facts and stood for a very narrow proposition in that case, which was that evidence of single witnesses, alleged crime victims, quote unquote, pattern of dishonesty did not constitute any evidence of factual innocence. Freeman is easily distinguished in this case. In fact, the language in Freeman specifically says this isn't a case, for example, where we have alibi witnesses. That's what the court held in Freeman.
Freeman also makes a statement, which I think the district court block quoted, saying that the phrase any evidence of factual innocence means any evidence that shows some fact establishing the absence of the petitioner's guilt. The evidence must show factual innocence. Is that the applicable test? And if so, can you satisfy it?
Absolutely. And the reference to factual innocence, in my view, is pretty clear from the case law that it's distinguishing the kind of innocence that you have in the case of the cases of Yang or Kingbird. In those cases, the conduct done by the defendants was at the time of the conduct deemed unlawful. It was not factual innocence, but the law under which they were convicted was interpreted to not include their what at the time was criminal conduct. So that was not evidence of factual innocence. Here we have, as the court is aware, actual evidence of factual innocence that Javon Davis did not attempt to murder the two individuals. He was not physically present at the time. We have alibi witnesses prepared to testify.
So, Mr. Leventhal, I'm wondering whether Freeman requires not just the existence of some evidence, but evidence that either does or is capable of establishing the absence of the petitioner's guilt. It seems to perhaps require conclusive evidence or a type of evidence that is qualified in a certain way by its strength or its convincingness or the ability to establish innocence. And I'm using other words to perhaps try to describe, because Freeman has only a few words, but the word establishing, it seems to me, is a key word. I'm wondering if you've thought about that, and if you have any thoughts about how that might apply to this case.
I have strong thoughts about that, Your Honor. The words in the statute are any evidence of factual innocence. They are not conclusive evidence. What follows after this hearing, I hope, is an actual hearing before the trial court where we bear the burden of proof. And that burden is a preponderance of the evidence. We have a right to that hearing because we have evidence of factual innocence. We don't have to show conclusive evidence. We don't have to establish he's innocent before we even have a hearing.
So it's your position, Mr. Leventhal, that evidence of any quality would satisfy the statutory requirement. For example, if the defendant testified that he was innocent, that is some evidence of actual innocence. So would that be enough? And then is there any defendant who would not? I mean, everybody would qualify under those circumstances.
No.
What is the threshold? I think that's Judge Johnson's question. What is the evidentiary threshold
you have to satisfy? In my view, the court's reservations and concerns have to do with the wisdom of the statute. If you look at the statute, it says any evidence, and any evidence includes a statement, I did not commit the crime. Now, I understand that the court could be legitimately concerned that there would be people making such a claim. As I pointed out at length in my papers, this is not the end of the inquiry. This only gives them a right to a hearing. And if the only evidence they have is their statement, I didn't do it, that probably is not going to meet the burden of a preponderance of the evidence, assuming there is evidence that they, in fact, did do it. So, again, if you focus on the statute, it says any evidence. That is not ambiguous. This court cannot view that with ambiguity. Neither word there is ambiguous. The words denomination are not ambiguous.
Mr. Leventhal, I guess my question is, for your proceeding under, let's say, the definition that you're looking at, C2 as opposed to C1, and so you are making a distinction there. And if someone's proceeding under C2, is it your position that the court is just never able to deny what I'll call an exoneration compensation hearing?
If a party has any evidence of factual innocence.
But how do you know if they have it? This is your argument, right? That you don't know what evidence might be presented if you don't have a hearing. And so my question are you then saying that the district court can never deny a request for compensation without having an exoneration compensation hearing when someone's proceeding under C2?
They have to come forward with the petition for the hearing, and they have to make statements in the petition. And if they do so...
So let's assume it's one of those kinds of categories of evidence noted in Freeman, in let's call it dicta, where Freeman says there wasn't alibi evidence. So let's assume in the petition under C2, they say, I have alibi evidence. It's error to deny that or to deny that petition without a hearing. The district court's required to have a hearing in that sense, in that instance.
I think it would be fair and appropriate to say, what is the alibi evidence? That's pretty abstract. But if they say, yes, my best friend is willing to take the stand and say I wasn't there, that is alibi evidence.
Mr. Leventhal,
dubious, and they might well lose their hearing.
Mr. Leventhal, it seems like you've identified your evidence on page 5 of your brief. I see references to cell phone, eyewitnesses, additional witnesses, gunshot injury. I don't see the word alibi.
I'm not a criminal defense lawyer, but when you're saying I physically wasn't there and I have witnesses who say I wasn't there, I was in a car miles away, that's an alibi, isn't it? I thought that's what an alibi is.
Okay. Well, so I'm asking you, I guess, what is your evidence of factual innocence? Does it include alibi evidence? And then can you tell us more about that alibi evidence? You know, what form, in other words, which witnesses or statements and so on?
Yes. At the time of the shooting, Javon Davis was in a car with 3 other individuals, two of whom will testify he was in the car at the time. And also, the third did testify that he was not in the car, but his testimony was impeached by 2 other witnesses who said, who have testified and offered affidavits that he had expressed a personal animus about Javon and wished to essentially cause him to be convicted. Those witnesses did not testify at trial, the alibi witnesses. They were not called to testify. They would testify at his exoneration hearing, as would Mr. Davis himself. In addition, there are cell phone records of Mr. Davis's phone at the time, on the phone, at the exact time of the murder, in a distant place, in the car on the way to a restaurant. The prosecution suggests that this was a so-called gang business phone, which didn't belong to Javon. That is not accurate. There is no such thing as a gang business phone. This was Javon Davis's phone. The trial court pointed out that Javon gave a different phone number to the police. There is no secret to the fact that Javon Davis was involved with criminal activity. He gave a different number, but it is his cell phone, and he will testify to it, as will the people who spoke with him on the phone at the time.
Mr. Leventhal, can you just clarify for me your position? Is it your position that the reason stated by the post-conviction court for exoneration is not a relevant consideration in determining the factual innocence of your client?
Well, after the amendment of the MIRA, it was made clear that you would be entitled to a hearing if you had any evidence of factual innocence, even evidence that wasn't available at the time. So, yes, the reason, and this is made clear, actually, post-Buell and by the amendment. The reason can be, as it was here, ineffective assistance of counsel, which arguably doesn't reflect one way or the other on guilt or innocence. But that simply cannot be the basis for denying a petition for compensation under the statute as it's now written. So I think in closing, I will just say that state's response that any evidence of factual innocence is ambiguous and that it defies easy dictionary definition simply can't be accepted. There is no word in any evidence of factual innocence which is ambiguous either by itself or in combination. Again, the court might have reservations about the statute as it's written. Plenty of people in Minnesota might have issues with the statute as it's written. But the job of this court and the trial court, of course, is to enforce the statute as it's written and defer to the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leventhal. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Good morning. Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Under either an unambiguous or ambiguous interpretation of Section 59011, Subdivision 1, appellant is not exonerated. And in Freeman, this court plainly stated, quote, to determine whether appellant satisfied the threshold exoneration requirement, we analyze the basis for the order vacating his convictions and granting him a new trial, end quote. This court then proceeded in Freeman to limit its analysis about whether Freeman was exonerated to the basis provided in the post-conviction order.
Mr. Petras, let me jump in here because it seems like that interpretation of Freeman is at odds with the language of C2 and the fact that there's a distinction between C1 and C2. C1, where you're exonerated based on factual innocence, and C2, the exoneration is not qualified. You don't have to be exonerated based on factual innocence. It's exonerated essentially for any reason, and there is evidence of factual innocence. So how do you square the distinction made in C1 and C2 with your reading of Freeman?
The difference in C1 and C2 exists because post-conviction relief can be obtained when a person receives the ineffective assistance of counsel. So let's look at clause C1. When the Board of Pardons, when that entity pardons or commutes a person's sentence, they do not do so because of ineffective assistance. That's simply not the way that a request for a pardon or a sentence commutation is presented to the Board of Pardons. Now let's turn to clause C2. Ineffective assistance of counsel can certainly be the legal vehicle by which a court grants post-conviction relief, including relief that is premised on the evidence of factual innocence. That's the whole point of including that additional language in C2, quote, whether it was available at the time of investigation or trial, end quote. This court effectively acknowledged in Freeman that a person can, under certain circumstances, on certain grounds, satisfy that threshold exoneration requirement via an ineffective assistance claim. But now let's look at the difference you identified there, Judge Brian, between based on versus and there is. Those are the differences. If the words, quote, and there is, end quote, in clause C2 were instead replaced with based on, I don't think it would be clear that an ineffective assistance claim can indeed be the basis for a finding of exoneration. That's because clause C2 would instead read, quote, conviction was vacated based on any evidence of factual innocence. Now, if a conviction is vacated based on ineffective assistance, because, for example, the trial counsel's failure to present known evidence of factual innocence, a literal reading of the rewritten clause 2 would not allow for a finding of exoneration because that conviction would technically be vacated based on ineffective assistance, not based on evidence of factual innocence. So the use of the words, quote, and there is, end quote, in clause C2, it really provides courts greater flexibility to analyze the actual grounds or the basis that a conviction is vacated. And it's critical to remember that the entire 40-word sentence that comprises clause C2 is itself a definition for the term, quote, on grounds consistent with innocence, end quote. The phrase, any evidence of factual innocence, simply cannot be interpreted without that context. Grounds means the basis or the reason for something. That is why this court held in Freeman that the basis for the order vacating a conviction is what matters when determining whether a person meets his burden to satisfy that threshold exoneration requirement.
But Mr. Petras, you're aware that in a post-conviction petition, a number of bases could be asserted, and the district court only needs to find one basis to grant the petition and need not reach all of the reasons for that may be meritorious. So it's possible that the district court could say, well, there was an effective assistance of counsel. I don't need to go any further. I don't have to analyze these alternative bases. There could also, in addition, be evidence of factual innocence that could be grounds for exoneration.
No, I agree with you, Judge Fish, that that is a possibility in a different hypothetical case, that the post-conviction order vacating the convictions may not be sufficiently clear to be able to determine the basis for the order. But here, the 142-page exhaustive order that Judge Scoggin assembled makes very, very clear that what the basis was and those three reasons that trial counsel was constitutionally ineffective. And it was not related to any claimed innocence or exoneration here. I want to address briefly the specific facts of that case or the specific facts of this case language that Mr. Leventhal referenced from Freeman. Well, that reference in Freeman refers to the specific conclusion that past incidents of unrelated dishonesty by the victim are not evidence of factual innocence. But it does not refer to Freeman's pronouncement that the basis for the order vacating a conviction determines whether that person was exonerated. I mean, consistent with what I was discussing with Judge Brian earlier, what the based on the specific facts statement in Freeman allows for, and what my office, the state, agrees with, is that there are certainly grounds that would support a successful ineffective assistance claim that would also amount to evidence of factual innocence. I cited a few examples in my brief on pages 17 and then 18 through 19. However, Judge Scoggin thoroughly addressed the specific facts in appellant's case in his lengthy order, and these specific facts also do not amount to evidence of factual innocence. I mean, as similar to how this court concluded in Freeman, the evidence, the three different ways in which trial counsel was ineffective here, the failure to object to the admission of the video recording of Walker's interview with the police, the failure to move to strike or seek some other type of curative measure following the state's presentation of Spriegel evidence at trial, and three, the failure to call two witnesses to attack the credibility of McGee, none of those reasons illustrated why, or I should say established, that the trial counsel was ineffective amount to evidence of factual innocence. As this court said in Freeman, the evidence does nothing to show appellant's lack of guilt for the charged offenses.
Mr. Petras, are you conceding that if we were to look beyond Judge Scoggin's reasons for granting post-conviction relief and look at other evidence that was not critical to his finding of ineffective assistance, that then we would have to conclude that Davis does satisfy the exonerated definition?
Judge Johnson, I'm conceding that if you guys took that, took that approach in this case and took that approach in other cases, going to the point that Judge Frisch asked about earlier, then in every single case in which a conviction is vacated, that yes, they would meet the threshold exoneration requirement, because in every single case, there is going to be some semblance of evidence, whether that would be the defendant denying guilt from the witness stand, whether that would be some sort of cross-examined question that the defense attorney would have asked the state witness, even in a case in which the defense is not put on a case.
Well, let's imagine a case which is fairly common where the defendant does not testify, does not put on any affirmative evidence. Defense counsel simply cross-examines state's witnesses, tries to perhaps challenge or undermine, question their testimony and their credibility. So it's simply a defensive case, putting the state to its burden of proof. And that's like I said, that seems fairly common. In that case, would that person, what evidence is there of of factual innocence in that kind of a case, given that hypothetical?
Judge Johns, with all due respect, I think I need to know a little bit more before I could confidently answer that question. I know that Judge Brian mentioned earlier that some of the passages in Freeman could be construed as dicta, and I very much understand that, but Freeman does allow for the possibility that impeachment evidence in and of itself can constitute any evidence of factual innocence. So in the case that you're describing, if there was cross-examination that was referencing certain impeachment evidence, I could see that that would potentially amount to any evidence of factual innocence if there was no connection whatsoever between the basis that the conviction is later vacated and that evidence of factual innocence, which I believe is what the defense is asking for. And frankly, I believe is what this court with a different panel decided in Hill, which is a case that I know is cited in
Mr. Petrus, if I could follow up, as we're talking about the way that the post-conviction motion informs or limits the exoneration availability, if there is some disagreement with trial counsel, let's say, about whether to present a witness or whether to ask a specific question or even whether to let the defendant testify, if there is some disagreement there as to trial strategy, that this court would say that's never going to be ineffective assistance, right? So it's not a basis for post-conviction. It seems like you're arguing that everybody asking for post-conviction relief would still have to put that argument into their motion for post-conviction relief just to preserve their later claim down the road. And I'm not sure that I interpret the case law of the statute as requiring parties to include all of that information in their post-conviction relief. Instead, it seems like they can make a post-conviction relief based on ineffective assistance, and then after the fact, tell the district court, this is all the evidence that we want to present at the exoneration compensation hearing, and include in that petition for exoneration compensation evidence that wouldn't have risen to the level of ineffective assistance. So why is that incorrect?
Well, this court said it was incorrect in Freeman. This court said, again, that they are limited to looking at the basis for the order vacating a conviction when determining whether someone satisfies that threshold exoneration requirement. And Freeman controls this court's decision in this case as a precedential decision. And I think going to your point, Judge Brian, something to consider is the fact that we only get to 590.11 if we have a conviction that has been vacated. So if you're talking about a post-conviction petition that lists, you know, it makes crude as, you know, trial strategy and thus would not amount to ineffective assistance, that's not going to get the conviction vacated in and of itself right there. So there would be something else that would need to have happened in that case. Presumably evidence of factual innocence, or maybe a procedural safeguard error, an evidentiary error, something that would need to have happened to get us to 590.11. So that's where I think that we, the reason that grounds consistent with innocence, the reason for the conviction being invalidated is important. That's why this court held so in Freeman. And that really controls as that threshold exoneration requirement, the gatekeeping function of 590.11, why we need to look at the order that vacates the conviction initially.
Seems you're putting a lot of weight on one word, the word basis, in that one sentence at the beginning of part two of Freeman. And I mean, let me give you my impressions and you can then tell me why I'm wrong. It seems like that paragraph is more in the nature of just a transitional, a prefatory statement about what the court is going to do next, announcing, you know, now we're going to turn our attention to the next subject, and there's no citation to a legal authority there. I don't think the Freeman court was attempting to state a pre-existing principle of law. Also, even if we were to think that our court was announcing a new rule of law prospectively, it doesn't say we analyze only the basis. So it doesn't say our analysis is limited to the basis, and that's limited is, I think, what you said earlier. It simply is, you know, maybe the court was just simply saying, We're next going to look at, for purposes of resolving this case, we're going to look at the order vacating convictions and see what the basis is. And that's the next step in our analysis without attempting to make any declarative statements governing future cases. Tell me why I'm wrong in that, if I were to take that approach to that paragraph of Freeman.
Hypothetically. Judge Johnson, I see that my time is running low. Oh. If I go a little bit over to answer your question.
Please feel free to give a reasonably full answer to the question.
Thank you. I think it's a situation where actions speak louder than words if we are not going to rely simply on the words this court used in Freeman. Because what this court did in Freeman is limit its analysis to solely the basis for the post-conviction order. Surely there was other evidence in that case, in Freeman at the trial level, that would have suggested some sort of innocence, a different type of impeachment evidence, other things, cross-examination questions, maybe even full-fledged defense witnesses, maybe the defendant testifying, that were part of the record. Obviously, this court did not analyze any of that when it was determining whether the threshold exoneration requirement had been satisfied, because it was limiting its analysis to just the basis that was provided in the order that vacated the conviction and granted the new trial in that case. And I understand that there are certain cases like the Supreme Court's decision in Dana Back, or this court's earlier precedential decision in Boole, which focused on the pre-amendment or addressed the pre-amendment version of 59011 that didn't have that any evidence of factual innocence language. But in both of those cases, the analysis is very clear if you reread them that it is looking only to the basis of the decision or the order that vacated the defendant's conviction as to determine whether or not the threshold exoneration requirement under subdivision one of the statute has been satisfied. I think, again, just to complete the answer, and I realize my time is short here, but you cannot look at that any evidence of factual innocence, even with the "and there is" piece included, without inserting it into what it actually defines in the statute, which is a conviction that is vacated on grounds consistent with innocence. There is no other way to define grounds than the reason for that the conviction was vacated. I realize my time is over. I do not intend to present any more argument, but before I turn the podium back over, I did have one clarifying question for the panel. I can address it to Judge Johnson about an email exchange that Mr. Leventhal and I had with the clerk of appellate courts yesterday regarding this case. My question specifically is, Ms. Rutherford emailed Mr. Leventhal and I to inquire about the existence of transcripts for the 3-day post-conviction hearing that occurred in this case. I have access to PDF copies of those transcripts. I, with all candor to the court, have not looked at them. They're about 360 some pages. I saw that they were not part of the district court record in this case. And so I did not think that they needed to be reviewed as I prepared my brief or I prepared for the argument today. They exist. If this court would like them, I'm happy to provide them in some fashion. I assume Mr. Leventhal may have a copy as well, although I do not know that for certain. Oh, Judge Johnson, you're muted.
I appreciate that statement. I'll pause to see if any other judge has any further questions for you. It appears not. Thank you, Mr. Petras. And Mr. Leventhal, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. There's some factual specific points to this case that bear emphasis. Mr. Davis's lawyer at the trial court was incompetent. He was ineffective as an advocate. Therefore, an emphasis on that record to make a determination of Mr. Davis's guilt or innocence is fundamentally unfair. Judge Scoggin was not even the trial court judge. It was Judge Karasoff, who unfortunately suffered a heart attack. Javon Davis did not testify in his own defense. He, of course, had a Fifth Amendment right not to testify. The record at an exoneration hearing will be substantially different because Mr. Davis will have competent lawyers. Mr. Davis will testify. Mr. Davis will have an orthopedic surgeon who will contradict, who will make it clear that Mr. Davis simply could not have engaged in the conduct that an eyewitness saw the night of the shooting. He could not have run away. As a light rail operator saw the shooter, saw him running away. This is evidence. It's actual evidence of factual innocence. And under the statute, Mr. Davis should have a right to bring that claim under the exoneration statute. I understand from the court's questioning and from opposing counsel's emphasis that supposedly anybody can bring a claim. That is really not what this court is to decide today. It's whether or not Mr. Davis has a claim under the statute as fairly and plainly read. Opposing counsel, in my view, takes 590.11C2, and he takes the words, "and there is any evidence of factual innocence," and he simply wishes this court to reread it, to read it to say, because there is any evidence of factual innocence. That's not what the statute says. That's not the plain meaning of the statute. And to bring it home, the statute says there is any evidence of factual innocence, whether it was available at the time of the investigation or trial, or is newly discovered evidence. That could be newly discovered after post-conviction relief, for example. That would be newly discovered evidence of factual innocence. And it wouldn't be, obviously, the basis for the post-conviction relief. And that's what the statute says. I have nothing further, Your Honors.
It appears there are no further questions for you. So the case is submitted.